He's a driver. Bill Lane crosses up. Van Vula, okie doke move, and lays it up for two. Lee with a nifty move there.
He could go all the way, and the freshman takes it to the house with no time on the clock. Are you kidding me? He takes it 60 yards. Welcome to Redbird Nation.
And the shoe. She gives it to Katie Broadway. Broadway taking it herself down the left side. No good. But she's going to get all the rebound. Kicks it out. Kansas Sykes for three.
Got it.
From local high school action to the birds and the pros, with live interviews, reporting, debate, and discussion, WDND's Red Zone brings you all the sports you can handle each week. The Red Zone starts now, only on 103.3 WDND, the pulse of Redbird Nation.
I hope you've got your fill of music for the day, because no more of that for like the next 4 or 5 hours. It's sports only on WZND, the pulse of Redbird Nation. Happy Thursday, birds. I'm Mikey Frenelli alongside David Moses and Braden Fogerson. First, we have a brand new edition of the Red Zone, an hour early, but a 15-minute longer. That's a little bit confusing. We're going to be going until about 6:15, and then into that, we will have Redbird Women's Basketball, the second-to-last regular season call of the season. That'll be Ben Hootie and Jamison Warfield on that call. But first, David, Braden, how are you guys doing? The whole crew's back together this week.
Don't you just love it? We get an extra 15 minutes to talk about sports.
We got a fifth segment today, Braden. What do you think about that?
I was very nervous when you changed up your intro that you would forget to say happy Thursday,
oh,
birds.
I could never.
I'm so glad that you were able to get that in there.
Do you guys know where that came from?
Not at all.
Was it said before you?
No. Leo would say something like, friends, enemies, and everything in between. That's what he would say. But no, mine was happy Thursday, birds, because when I was a sophomore last year, I did like one of the first newscasts of the year during, I think it was a Friday. And so I said, happy Friday, birds, at some point, I think at the beginning or the end or something. And like somebody, one of the higher ups here was like, we can't be saying that during newscasts, like it's informal, whatever. And I remember, I think it was Leo was like all for it. And then Cammy, who was the news director at the time, and then Maritza, who was the news and sports operations director, this is a whole lot of shout outs. They both were like, it's funny, but never do it again. So when I preceded Leo as sports director, I said, I'm going to start saying happy Thursday, birds, to open the Red Zone, just to spite you guys every single week.
And the legend continues to grow.
Maybe I'll start saying happy Thursday, birds and Titans and all Blono residents and all fans of the Cubs and Bears and Bulls. But in this edition of the Red Zone, we're going to talk a little bit first about the Redbird men's team. I feel like before the show started, Braden said something like he's running out of ways to say this team is bad. And that couldn't be more true after a 30-point loss last night to top of the conference Drake. One game left in the regular season, currently sitting tied for that 10 seed with Valpo ahead of the conference tournament. A win against the worst team in the conference, Evansville, on Sunday will secure the 9 seed, assuming Valpo also loses to Murray State. But that is a difference in game time for Thursday. It could be a noon game next Thursday or a 6 o'clock game. David, for you and I who are going to be there in St. Louis, that's a big deal.
And it's scary. We've lost the last 6 games, the last 2, by 10 or 15 points plus. Like you said, what was the last game? 30 plus, actually?
Yeah, it was 31. It was 82-51 Drake last night.
Just a terrible way to enter conference season, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
Typically, you want to see teams peaking, catching their stride, and really starting to come as a collective into a powerhouse club. You're not seeing that with this Redbirds team, which is very sad. You got players that like to produce on a consistent basis, but it's just not enough. Seneca Knight, Darius Burford, Kendall Lewis, just all, they've been, you know, pretty good assets for the team. It just hasn't really, you know, clicked.
Yeah, I mean, this team, I said this to somebody who was actually interviewing me for a story the other day for a class. They were talking about, since I talk about this team so much, we all do, like, what's been the main positive in such a rough season? I guess it's just that the wealth is spread, right? Like David said, like you have individual great performances night in and out from Darius Burford, from Seneca Knight, Kendall Lewis, Malachi Poindexter, Haruna Sissoko, but at the end of the day, none of them have clicked at the same time, and I can only imagine what could have happened if that ever came to be, or if it still does.
But we talked.
Go ahead.
We talked about it before, really quick. Coach Peyton, he doesn't really like to go into his bench a lot.
No.
And I think that it would have been useful for times like this when you just can't really seem to find a spark on the team other than, like I said, those three key players that have really produced all year. But, you know, it's important to have a deep bench, especially for when your team hasn't really found success putting up points, staying on the defensive side, being an anchor on the defensive side. It's just, it hasn't really clicked, and it would have been a good question, what would the Redbirds look like today if Coach Peyton went in his bench a little bit more?
I would say, going back to your question about the positives, there have been our fair share of games that they were close losses at least, and you can make certain adjustments throughout a game and change that outcome, as opposed to a lot of games. There's been several lately, Bradley, Indiana State, Drake, but throughout the majority of the season, it's been a lot of games that were close losses and that you can make adjustments off of, as opposed to games where they were just so far off that no amount of adjustments in the world, no amount of game planning in the world is going to change that disparity between talent. So I think there's a lot to be able to build on in those games. I still think they're definitely a long way off from the tops in the conference, but they are at least, you know, solid enough to be on par with some of the other teams that are at Illinois State's caliber.
I don't know, man. This team, I was joking about what Braden said before we started, and he's not completely wrong. Like, we're running out of ways to say, you know, wait till next year. This team is stinks. It's just like the Bears. It's pretty funny. But the thing is, they do have some positives, and I hate keeping saying it over and over and over again, but it's like you look at the positives and you get concerned why they're not winning some of these games, why they're losing six games in a row when they are, you know, shooting so decently and having these individual performances, and Seneca Knight's been on such a tear through this losing streak. I mean, what is the reason for six straight losses, and where does it come to the point where you can't finish off games?
Well, basketball is a team sport, and when you have Darius Burford averaging 29 a game, Seneca Knight averaging 30.9, 31 out of Kendall Lewis, 31.8 out of Malachi Poindexter. I mean, 26.5 out of Luke Kasubke. That's your top five that are all getting ridiculous minutes. And then everyone else on the bench is just kind of very, very low. They get very little amount of time in a game to work on their ability to get in-game reps. And when you have that little depth, your team cannot survive if you're basically a five-man team, even if they do have quite a bit of talent. And there is quite a bit of talent on this starting five for Illinois State. You still can't afford to go throughout a long basketball season when you're coaching a team that you can't trust any of the bench guys to come in and be reliable.
But, you know, that's going to be a thing that, you know, a lot of people in the whole organization of the team are going to say this summer, we need to do a better job at least scouting or recruiting different talent, because if you don't trust your bench, I mean, that falls on ultimately the recruiters and the talent that we bring in. We're going to have to do a better job in the summer or in the off season for college basketball to bring in better talent so that we can have a well-rounded team.
The one positive, I talked to Bill Salyer, who is the sports information director for men's basketball. I talked to him on Monday, and some of our recruits are looking really, really solid in their high schools. Ty Pence out of St. Joseph, he's looking really solid among other recruits. And so it seems like Coach Ryan Peden's first true recruiting class, because he had kind of an abridged recruiting year last season coming in halfway through the offseason, seems like his first true group of freshmen coming in next year should make an impact early on. But will it be enough to go up against these powerhouses in the Missouri Valley who – there is no one good team. They're just all beating up on each other, but there's a couple teams now that are only, you know, four losses, five losses.
But even then, when you have recruits that come in, that's even going to take time, because very rarely do you see a true freshman come in and make an immediate impact on, you know, a college-level team. You know, we might see some guys that make it to the league do that, but, you know, obviously, you know, we will never know. So I think that next season, even saying next season, we're going to see a traumatic change in how we are able to, you know, consistently perform is even a stretch, but, you know, who knows? You know, we'll see.
Yeah, and if you look at all the fundamental stats of the ones where if a coach is mad about his team losing, he'll make them run laps in practice over, free throws and rebounds being two main ones. Illinois State has out-rebounded and outshot at the free throw line their opponent this season. By quite a good margin as well. They're shooting 7-9-3 on free throws against a 6-9-3 for their opponents. And then also being able to out-rebound as well. Those are two key stats that, although the scoring needs to be better, although the assists, they need to be able to work a little bit better as a team for sure. Turnovers is definitely a category that needs to be improved. Those are two really key stats that they have done really well with.
So, Mikey, earlier you talked about this game and other games being implications to, you know, the seeding and the timings that, you know, the Redbirds play. You know, they're going against the Evansville team that this is almost a surefire win, at least you would hope, right?
Yeah, I mean, it gives me a good chance to segue into the conference standings. There's 12 teams in the Valley. All 12 get an automatic bid into the Missouri Valley Conference Championship. That said, it is pretty much apparent at this point that the only team going all the way to the big dance will be whoever wins that tournament, because there's no real team in this group that, like I said, is, you know, there's no two undefeated teams or two one-loss teams. Drake and Bradley at the top, 15-4. Southern, Indiana State, and Belmont, all 13-6. Missouri State, 11-8. Murray State, 10-9. UNI, 9-10. Valpo and Illinois State, 5-14. UIC, who has actually gone on a little bit of a tear since they lost to ISU for like their 10th straight loss. They've won two in a row, 4-15, so they're coming up. And then Evansville, 1-18 in the conference. So, yes, to answer David's question, the ultimate knock on wood, you would think that this game against Evansville at home on Sunday, senior night, for Colton Sandage and I believe Seneca Knight, I believe are the two guys leaving? You would think that that is hopefully a win and should secure ISU at least the 9 seed, so they go into that tournament playing the 8 seed instead of playing the 10-7 game on Thursday. But nothing is considered a win at this point. Illinois State having lost 6 in a row. How about Drake last night? Their 10th win in a row over Illinois State. I should say 10th win in a row in the conference this season, but it also happened to be over Illinois State. And it may very well be also their 10th win in a row against Illinois State, you know, based on the last couple of years. But yeah, it's just this conference is really spread out at this point when it comes to just talent divide. And it's kind of interesting to see UIC kind of build up a little bit like that. I mean, Fogerson, you and I were both on that game when ISU played UIC and that overtime win. David, you were there as well for TV. We were both in that press conference, or all of us were in that press conference. Yeah,
but I knew from that game that they were a lot better than I mean, ISU ultimately won that game, but that backcourt for UIC, it was just they were raining threes. They were high motor.
Yes.
You can tell that they were interacting with the crowd. They had the passion for the game, and they didn't seem like they were too outmatched. But like obviously the Redbirds were able to push through that game in overtime.
UIC has Southern Illinois on Sunday, so if ISU falls in a tough loss to Evansville and USC beats Southern, they could also overtake ISU or at least tie them in the standings, which I believe ISU would still have that tiebreaker though. What an end of the season for USC. And Southern Illinois is not unbeatable. They started off the season really, really well, but they've lost to ISU now. They lost to Bradley just last weekend. They got really, really whomped by Drake to the point where it was 40-14 in the first half at one point. So SIU has been all over the place. So that could be a regular season Cinderella story to see USC bump up like 3 seeds before the tournament.
Yeah, and to add context to the Evansville game, it was a 69-61 win on the road the last time they played. So it was pretty close, but again, they had the home team advantage. They actually had 6,487 in attendance, and if that's correct, I don't know if they're just making up their attendance numbers, because that team is not a team that should be filling up an arena like that.
Have to be giving out jerseys.
Yeah, because they that is the highest in attendance that Illinois State has seen either at home or on the road this season. Looking at the records that we have, that is the most well-attended game, home or away, that Illinois State has dealt with this season. So I think when you have the home team advantage, it becomes even easier to be able to beat them.
15 minutes gone, but don't worry, we still have an hour of Red Zone left. You're listening to The Red Zone.
This is Barstool Big Cat, and you're listening to The Red Zone on 103.3 WZND.
And welcome back into The Red Zone. We have another segment for you. We have not had an interview in a week or two, and then I had the pleasure this week to talk to Adrian Flores of the Illinois State baseball team. He had a really hot start. We'll get into the stats during this, but here is a quick 10-minute interview I had with Illinois State baseball catcher Adrian Flores. Although it has been a cold start to the season weather-wise, the Illinois State baseball team has kept their bats hot, scoring over 13 runs twice already this season. At 2-2 on the year, one player that has stood out early on is Adrian Flores, who is batting .500 with two RBIs, three runs, and a walk through only two starts and three appearances. I sat down with the second-year catcher to discuss his hot start, his team, and of course what we should expect in 2023. Of course, I couldn't start the interview without asking Adrian what's the key for all of his recent success.
I can't pinpoint one thing. It's just I'm just seeing the ball well right now and just sticking to my approach, the approach that we have as a team.
What is that approach that you preach as a team? Maybe is it something Coach Holm tells you guys, or what is that?
Yeah, it's something that him and Wally have gone over with the team. It's just attacking right out the gate. As you can see, some of our games, we try and get ahead first and hunt fastballs, and that's what we try and do.
So what is it about getting ahead, you know, in the count and also in the score that helps you guys get out to some leads in some of these games? I mean, 2-for-2 in the season, but some high-scoring games, man. Two games in which you scored over 13 runs. So is that contributing to that first ball mentality?
Yeah, I think that contributes a lot to it, because instead of being timid, getting deeper into counts, we're being more aggressive, whereas not really letting the pitcher settle in too much. And that's something they also kind of preach, is don't let the other guy settle in. You don't want a starter going 5-6 innings. We want to get right to their bullpen as soon as possible, and that's what helps with attacking first, sitting, looking for fastballs, just being aggressive early.
What have you seen so far from some of your guys' younger players or newer players joining the team and making an impact early on?
They're all aggressive. They're all aggressive when you go to bat. They're all fun. They love the game of baseball just like how we do, and we're out there just having fun. And I think we all click very well.
Was it cold yesterday playing back in Illinois after being in Tennessee and going to Arkansas next week? Was it weird being back here, kind of back home?
It was colder in Tennessee than it was yesterday.
Oh, actually?
Yeah.
Couldn't tell.
No, yeah, it was cold down there in Tennessee. Good thing they had heaters, so that helped. But it was Friday night. It was really cold. Saturday was okay, but I would say Sunday, that was probably the best day weather-wise, but Friday and Saturday were pretty cold.
Well, it helps us the best day at the longest game, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Well, talk me through that game a little bit. I mean, obviously, ended up winning that one, but it took a lot in extra innings.
Yeah.
What was the mentality there when you're seeing a lot of players touch the field? And as you said, it wasn't the nicest weather, so what was that like?
So as you saw, we went down, what was it, 10-5?
I believe so.
Yeah, so we went down, and it was so early into the game. I think none of us, our infield is pretty old and mature, so all of us kept our composure pretty well and handled the adversity pretty well. We knew that we had 5 more innings to go, so, and that their field played really small. And I think part of having an older infield and maybe new guys in the outfield at the corners, you have Augie in right field. He's played a year, and also freshman Casella in left field. I think having the older dudes / returners kind of helped the team kind of be more settled and not really on our like heels when we were down 5.
So I'm changing the subject a little bit, but I mean, maybe a little bit to do with the weather. You're a California guy, and it seems like Coach Holm is really preaching to those California guys to tell you, come on down to ISU, come be in the Midwest. And what's that been like so far, playing baseball somewhere so far away from home?
I do miss home. It's not the weather. It's more just family, my dog, just stuff like that. The weather doesn't bother me too much, but I think if you're coming out here for baseball and education, you can miss home, but you don't really think about it too much. You're just out here doing what you do and doing what you love.
What kind of dog do you have?
She's a little Yorkie poo.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I love her. Nice little dog.
So they say, you know, the shortstop's running the infield, but I feel like the catcher has just as much of an important job too. And you haven't played a lot of games last year and playing a lot of the games so far this year. Have you seen yourself take on a little bit of a leadership role here now?
I think a lot of us look up to Luke Chang, because he, as you saw last year, he kind of commanded the infield with those insane plays that he makes look so easy. But I would say as a returner, I wouldn't call myself a leader, but I do think that some of the younger dudes look up to me and how I present myself and carry myself a little bit. But I would say in that sense, yes.
So what should we be excited for Redbird fans and media and stuff like that when you guys come home in March? What should we look forward to? I mean, cool new jerseys, but other than that.
Yeah, I would say something to look forward to is just a lot more runs. I think with this ball club, with our team, with our lineup, you'll see a lot more action. You'll expect a lot more. And that's what this team, I think, is really good at. We'll put the ball in play a lot, and you'll expect a lot of runs and stuff like that.
So talk about this upcoming trip. You're going to be in Arkansas for most of a week, Arkansas State and then Arkansas. What's the team mentality going there?
Win. Go out there and win. Don't let it speed up. Just breathe. That's another thing we've been preaching. When you feel like yourself, you've been thinking too much, maybe up at the plate. If you're a pitcher and stuff starts going a little bit too fast, you just got to kind of take a step back, breathe, just kind of reset and make sure you breathe. Because as long as you breathe, you kind of slow down your heart rate. You kind of become more present compared to thinking or maybe not even thinking. So I think also breathing, kind of being in the present, and I think that'll help us win and just play our game.
And I didn't even note that you guys have Central Arkansas too, so it's going to be a decent trip down there.
Yeah.
To have the Razorbacks in a midweek like that after having a whole series last year, or is that something you guys are looking forward to, just a one and done against that top team?
I wouldn't say it's something. It would be fun to have a series against them, but for us, it's just another game. We hope to go in there, play our game, and win.
Is that the general mentality for midweek games always? Like, do you look into those games any different than a weekend series, or does the team prepare differently?
No, we just go in there, try and play the same game we play every single game, every series. Just try, do our best, have fun, play our game. Don't let it speed up like on its own, and just breathe and just try to handle any adversity like well and just come out on top.
So I hate to put you on the spot, but is there any other teams looking over your schedule for the year that you're really looking forward to facing off against?
To be honest, I don't really know too many teams out here. The only team that I got excited for to go back to was Arkansas. The atmosphere there last year was just it was crazy. So that was the one game like I'm excited to go back to. But other than that, I'm personally a guy that doesn't really care about the schedule. It's just another team, another group of players around our same age. Just go out there and play baseball.
So we talked about winning, but what's another goal you have just for yourself going through the rest of this season?
Goal for myself is just to stay present and continue to stay consistent. Because consistency for me is the best thing. With my routine, how I go about my at-bats, and just everything like that.
Good luck in Arkansas. As you said, go out there and win. We're all pulling for you. Thanks, Adrian.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
So consistency is the key. That's what Adrian says. Just a great interview I had with him. He seems like a really solid guy. A lot of those California guys that Steve Holmes brought in are just really chill dudes, and they just love to talk about baseball. They love to play, and they all preach consistency. That's something that Steve Holmes must hammer home, and Wally Cranser and the rest of that coaching staff. But it's interesting, this road trip that the Redbird baseball team is going on, it's 2 weeks in Arkansas. It's Arkansas State, then a midweek at number 3 Arkansas, and then Central Arkansas. So it's everywhere.
That's actually
there.
So funny.
And it's funny because I won't name drop anyone here, but another WZND person came up to me today and was telling me a story that they live next to one of the Redbird baseball players who put a note under their door today and said, hey, could you, if any packages come, could you please just like bring them inside your place or whatever so I can come get them back so they don't get stolen. They're going to be gone for most of 2 weeks. So it's nuts. And I don't know what that means for their classes or what, but it's pretty crazy that they're going to be gone for 2 whole weeks off in Arkansas. But hey, it's a lot warmer than here.
Yeah, let's see how they respond to it. Like you said, it's been a pretty, they want to preach consistency. You know, they're .500, so what's more consistent than that?
Yeah, right.
But the wins that they have had have been pretty impressive. 13 runs in the first win, 14 in the second. So, you know, they've shown that they can let that bat fly, and when they do, it results to pretty good measures.
And you're still early in the season, so this is when you're figuring out who can bat well where, who can come into certain spots out of the bullpen, you know, who's good late in games, who's good as a long reliever. All that stuff is in the feeling out phase right now. As this Illinois State team figures things out about how they want to be able to manage, that'll get them better for when they get to conference play.
So it's crazy because Adrian was a cool interview, but also, I mean, him starting so well as a catcher is a good sign, because when we had Ben Huddy on last weekend talking about the Redbird baseball team and what he heard from Coach Holm and on his beat, he said that was one of the only positions where they didn't have a set guy. And to see one of their catching candidates do so well early on means maybe they found their guy through last year when they didn't really have one in the beginning of this year. I mean, he's hitting, like I said in the interview, he's hitting .500. He has two RBIs. Two hits, four RBIs. He's doing really, really well. And honestly, couldn't have a better dude. Seems like a really cool guy.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, it was so nice to be able to get to hear him, you know, talk about how he feels about it all. I didn't really expect the voice to be the way it was.
Yeah, I was
kind of
say,
fun to listen to.
He's one of those guys you can listen to him talk for just hours.
Yeah, I don't know. I hope he's listening, or Scott or anyone like that, but he has, and so many of his teammates do, he has that California voice to him where he's just chill and, you know, like David said, just want to hear him keep talking.
Yeah, and at a position like that, you need to be able
right.
to communicate well. You're talking all the time with your, I mean, really anyone that's playing baseball mm-hmm. on the field is communicating, but especially that position, you need to be able to communicate well with everyone.
Every other Illinois State sport attracts people from Illinois and Wisconsin for their sport or overseas, but baseball, Illinois State baseball, is all Canadians and Californians. That's basically the whole team. And then with the exception of Liam McChesney on the Redbird basketball team, he's the only other Canadian. It seems like all the other Canadians in ISU athletics are on the baseball team. And because David's cracking up, we're going to do it for this segment here. We'll be back to have Luke Biondi on the show. You're listening to The Red Zone.
Hey, this is Katie Weimerskirch, and you're listening to The Red Zone.
And welcome back to The Red Zone. I'm Mikey Frehley alongside David Moses. And then our resident racing experts here, we got Braden Fogerson, my normal co-host, and then WZND's Luke Biondi, who's been a valuable member of our WZND News and Sports team for the whole year now. But this is your first time in The Red Zone, I believe, right?
Yes, sir, it is.
So are you excited to be here? I know you're normally more of a news-oriented guy, but this is our big sports show. Are you excited to be here?
Yeah, I am pretty excited to be here. I find myself as passionate as I am about Formula One with a few sports, so...
Yeah, good. Well, you know, I heard that you have a topic you want to talk about today, and I will even admit that last semester of this show, I definitely tried to steer clear away from talking about racing as much as we could, because Dane, David, and I had no clue what we were talking about. But now that we have Braden Fogerson, I had no choice but to tell you guys, to tell us and the listeners, what's going on in the world of Formula One.
Yeah, so Luke, just start me out. F1 had their testing today. What have you been able to notice and pick up on about, you know, things that are new about this season?
Well, the biggest thing for me is Fernando Alonso's performance with Aston Martin. You know, there were questions going into this season with his transition from Alpine, and Aston Martin obviously didn't perform that well this year, but... this morning, Fernando Alonso was able to pull out second in a 200th second gap to Max Verstappen, who was the champion last year. And the next person closest behind him was Carlos Sainz in the Ferrari. He was 4/10 back. So Fernando Alonso and Max Verstappen were almost half a second ahead of the whole pack. So it's really nice to see Fernando Alonso, especially somebody so experienced, such a veteran, kind of taking a chance with a new team and seeing it work out at least this early. Hopefully that gives them some confidence going into the season.
And so for when I watch NASCAR early in a season, it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, if there's one driver that stands out, even though they don't normally, not to say that Alonso doesn't, because he had some good runs late in the season. How much does this mean, this mid-season, you know, their off-season testing, how much does that correlate to when they are actually performing in the regular season? I know Verstappen being dominant is no change over the past several years, but just what does this mean to you in terms of how close you think this testing session will be to how the regular season goes?
Well, like you said, I feel consistency is key, and you see the top five, Lando, Charles, Carlos, and Fernando and Max. They all struggled with reliability last year, and they all besides Max, got worse results than they were hoping for because of reliability issues. I think the teams we will have to look at the most for reliability will be AMR and Alpine, because they both have the talent with Fernando Alonso. And Alpine just got Pierre Gasly, but Alpine was making a run later in the season last year, but they kind of fell behind because of those reliability issues. So on that, I feel like reliability is the key.
So for me, someone who isn't as knowledgeable in NASCAR and in the world of sports racing, what would you say is more beneficial for a race driver? Is it sheer speed, or does technique fall into play into that, whether it be wider turns, narrow turns, or what is it that creates the most efficient racer?
Great question, David. I'll take this one. Kidding. Luke, do you want to give us the answer to this one? Because I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't really know either. I feel like it's mostly a mental thing, you know? You look at, I hate to keep bringing it up, but you look at Max Verstappen and he's ice cold, you know? He doesn't show any emotion when he's racing. He's always just 100% focused. His main goal is to always win. He doesn't get distracted. And he's had his tragic incidents. He's had his problems, but he continues to stay focused.
And so for me to be able to answer your question, David, it kind of depends on the sport, how much or little talent versus equipment matters. I know in F1 there's just nothing but talent all throughout. In NASCAR there's a lot of people with a ton of talent, and then just a couple people in the bottom tier that just have really bad, not very competitive rides, and because of the fact that these people aren't all that talented, they get to fill those out because the last thing they want to be doing is spending a ton of money on a driver when really there's a lot of other resources to be able to gain on. So it depends on the sport, but in NASCAR's sense, there's definitely a lot of different tiers in terms of talent.
All right, I got a question. You've seen the resurgence this year and in past years of sports reality TV shows. I think you guys know where I'm going with this. And Full Swing, the PGA show, just came out to great reviews. They're making an NFL one called Quarterback with Pat Mahomes and Kirk Cousins and Marcus Mariota. But it all has the roots of this, or this big tree of these reality TV shows, its roots are Drive to Survive, which I remember watching, actually, a couple years ago with my roommate. And I do not have any interest in F1, and that's not meant to be offensive. I just never have. But I remember enjoying Drive to Survive. What do you think that meant for people like myself or David, who don't have anything to do with the sport itself, turning it into a show like that? Do you think that really grew the game a little bit?
Yeah, I feel like you have the new race in Vegas, you have the new race in Miami. I don't feel like those would be possible without Drive to Survive, especially in America. Since it was through Netflix, it gave so much exposure to the sport that it has increased the popularity a lot in the last couple of years, and it's great to see. Even though I have heard some complaints that the show could be dramatized and it's not quote unquote true to the sport.
Well, yeah,
the world of all reality TV.
Well, yeah, I think it's valid too, because my next question was, I was watching Full Swing, the first couple episodes, and I'm a pretty big golf fan, and I was kind of, you know, like, not, I liked it a lot. I liked the human aspect of it, but as some of the spots, especially in the early episodes, where they're like explaining the rules of golf and stuff like that, that kind of annoyed me, but I understand why it had to be there. And I'm sure when you guys were watching Drive to Survive, you felt the same way. Like, you probably felt like it was pandering a little bit to people who don't know what they're talking about, and that probably had to be annoying, right?
Well, not to be the guy that just constantly brings this F1 conversation back to NASCAR, but that's, of course, how I relate to it. NASCAR tried to do their own version of Drive to Survive, and they did it through USA Network. Not going to be nearly as big of an audience as Netflix is. And then also, you know, just in general, you know, what sort of audiences are you going to be able to get from it? It is huge to be able to grow your sport, especially a sport that's not as big as football or baseball, when you can have something like that that can get an American audience interested in your sport. And in F1's, in the case of F1, they hugely grew the popularity of their sport and their ability to market to America, because it had always been seen as a European-focused sport, and they had just, like, have one race at Circuit of the Americas, and now they have three races that they're able to run each season in America, and it is hugely more popular, and that is a way to grow any sport.
That's your target market, though, right? I mean, I was complaining about Full Swing doing that with, you know, explaining golf, but you're trying to explain racing to American fans who aren't as interested yet, hoping they come interested. And then, like Luke said, the show comes out, and then I remember last year I watched the Miami one in and around the Dolphin Stadium, and you see pictures of Michael Jordan and Tom Brady and Lewis Hamilton all hanging out together and posting on social media, and people know who Lewis Hamilton is now too, which is kind of cool that, you know, the show at least brought that to American minds.
But, you know, I think it's fair to say in today's age, you know, it hasn't really been endorsed that much, but as a kid, this was my first toy. the NASCAR race car was my first toy, and then you elevate it to a teenage level, go to Dave and Buster's, and you play the racing game in any arcade that you see. That's how it was endorsed to me. Yes, that has slowed down over the days. Maybe that's something we get back to endorse it to not even just young guys, but anybody who wants to learn more about racing. I know that was one of my favorite things as a kid.
And to be able to go back to the testing that we saw, there's a few new people perhaps trying to figure out how they run. Oscar Piastri, I believe, for McLaren. I mean, he's brand new. And Lando Norris being top five, I mean, you know that that's the level that McLaren is able to get to. But he's brand new. Do you have any thoughts on these new people in terms of their talent, where they're coming from, and, you know, are you excited about these people as they grow?
Well, I have some thoughts on McLaren specifically. You see Lando is at 5 and Piastri is at 18, and that's kind of representative of how McLaren's done for the past year and a half. Lando has stood out a lot, but is Piastri going to take that Daniel Ricciardo spot? Is he going to be the anchor that sinks the McLaren ship, that brings them down to that 4th, 5th in the constructor standings, if Lando is able to put out these consistent performances?
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, McLaren used to have Lewis Hamilton before he switched to...
Yeah.
So, like, what sort of happened as a result? Of course, you can predictably say that McLaren's not as strong without Lewis Hamilton as they were when they had him. But, you know, has there been a big change in terms of the strength of McLaren, and how risky is it that they're... you know, perhaps considering worrying about falling down the rungs?
Well, I feel like the team morale has just gotten worse since, like, the early 2010s with the leaving of Lewis Hamilton and the new drivers. They were never able to have a really steady star. You know, they're one of the standout teams in F1, but they never really had that standout driver that they needed. And they hope that Daniel Ricciardo could be that for them. He wasn't. I'm hoping Lando could be that for... be their standout driver for, like, the next 5-10 years. But without that real face of the franchise, McLaren has been struggling.
So, you know what's kind of interesting? I want to ask you guys, and not to take too much away from what you guys are talking about with this season of F1 racing, but I just have another, you know, kind of question for those who aren't as well tuned into it. I've always kind of wondered, how do you come up in the rankings as a child or as a teenager or in college and racing? Like,
yeah,
you know, and I've always wondered, like, I remember asking my dad this as a kid, like, how does that work? He didn't even know, like, you know, in college baseball, travel baseball, and you play high school baseball, then you play college baseball, and then hopefully the MLB, and every other sport fits that mold. How do you come up as a racer?
Again, there's different ways to do it. There's certain NASCAR drivers, Jeff Gordon, my favorite of all time, and Tony Stewart came up through the ranks and became superstars through open wheel driving. They first loved the Indy 500 and wanted to become Indy stars, and then they turned to stock car racing when that was a better way to market themselves. There's new drivers today, like Chase Briscoe, for example, Christopher Bell, Kyle Larson, that came up through dirt racing. And then in terms of back to open wheel F1, correct me if I'm wrong, it's a lot of being able to do, you know, kart racing and Formula E, and then you build your way up to Formula One, right?
Yeah, and I feel like NASCAR, one benefit NASCAR has over Formula One is you do get a lot of those blue collar, like, working class people who work their way up from the bottom of, like, casual go-kart racing, where in F1 it's more legacy. All these drivers have super wealthy families, their parents were F1 drivers. But NASCAR does kind of have that, you know, the drivers are more relatable, and they can be better characters.
Yeah, and my roommate Zach is a huge F1 fan, and he always reminds me that he thinks that Formula One's better than NASCAR any chance he gets. But when he talks about the drivers in F1, he does say that too, that people like Max Verstappen, he's the superstar, but he's always, you know, he's had all the resources it took. He said Lewis Hamilton's a guy that's maybe not an example of that, but yeah, for the most part, F1 is a lot of people that just have always had those resources around them. And, you know, as long as you're not messing up too much, you work your way up the ranks.
That's really, really interesting. And I think another thing, we talked about how F1 has become Americanized through Drive to Survive. I saw something about NASCAR is doing a Chicago event this summer.
Yeah.
In July. You guys want to talk a little bit about that?
So the Chicago Street Course event, it's going to be along, like, Lakeshore Drive. It's going
That's so
to be
cool.
On 4th of July weekend. It is taking a sport that I don't want to be negative about NASCAR, but NASCAR is a rural sport for a reason. F1 is an urban sport for a reason. If you bring F1 to Miami, to Las Vegas, they're going to be well received because that's the type of market you're going for. When NASCAR brought racing to Chicago, when NASCAR got big in the early 2000s, it didn't always work out. And to be sending NASCAR to a street course race, sure, it's awesome. It's a cool idea, but you sometimes can't force that on the market. If F1 did the exact same thing, it would work super well, but NASCAR does much better when they are marketing to their actual, core group of audiences, which is why their all-star races at North Wilkesboro, which is a very rural area, but it has been beloved by NASCAR fans. It went away in the mid-90s. But so many of the stars of yesteryear cut their teeth there. That's why a lot of NASCAR fans are more excited about an event like that than an event like Chicago, even though you would expect in a bigger market like Chicago, NASCAR fans would be more excited about.
You call it street racing. Like, are they actually racing on Lakeshore
Drive? They're going to be on the street, yeah.
Wow.
So they're going to be right turns? Yeah, so you... Yeah.
No way. I didn't think those cars turn right.
So NASCAR has really upped their ability to put road course racing into their schedule as a whole, and that's been good for them. In this case, they're just like putting walls up and making security measures, and then they are literally going to be running on the same streets that there are like pedestrians walking along and drivers driving on in traffic right now. That is where they're going to be. So it's turning an everyday part of Chicago, an everyday part of the streets of Chicago, into a racetrack. And it's literally just bringing the sports right to the third largest media market in the country.
I don't know if anyone heard David before Braden started answering, but whoever the next mayor is has got to be concerned about filling all the potholes and making the streets look better before the...
Could there not be no race going on?
Yeah, no. Let's just have a street race in downtown Normal and Bloomington. That way we can get all our potholes.
I tell you what, though. It's one thing that always mesmerizes me when I see it on TikTok. The pit stops.
Yes.
They get them done like 2.3, 3.0. I'll be like, yeah. Oh my God.
F1 does it even faster than NASCAR because they can literally lift the cars up and do it, and they have like 20 people on a pit crew. NASCAR can do it in 10 seconds, but the cars are heavier and they have less people. So
I don't know if we'll be able to fill this segment. And actually, we don't even have to cut it off. We have to cut it off, but we don't have to. Like, we feel like we could keep talking for a while. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to get into the NBA and one of our very own experience at the NBA All-Star Game. You're listening to The Red Zone.
Hey, this is Dickie V, baby, and you're listening to The Red Zone, baby, only on 103.3 WCMD.
You heard Dickie V. Welcome back into The Red Zone. I can't believe we have that bump. I think that's like, a good 6-7 years old by now. A former sports director got that one recorded. Maybe if we ever run into another famous announcer, maybe in the conference tournaments or something, we're going to have to get something like that. Speaking of which, David, you met some interesting people over the last week, correct? You were out, well, we were here in Normal, you were out in Salt Lake City. What was that about? How was that?
Oh my goodness, it was one of the best experiences I've had so far, just being able to go down there and see how it operates to run an all-star weekend. It was very informative. I was able to meet a lot of people, network, and yeah, man, from the moment I got off the plane, I saw Shaquille O'Neal and his guys with him.
Wow.
And that was probably the largest human being I've ever seen in my life.
So you were up close and personal, so you got to see Shaq?
You got to see Shaq. Didn't say anything to me. Yeah. I didn't.
He's got a whole crew around him.
Yeah, I was a little nervous about it. Starstruck is the word.
I mean, you're a pretty big guy. I mean, you're a pretty large guy. Can you imagine Shaq making you feel
that
small?
Guy,
that's crazy.
Oh, my goodness. He was humongous. Absolutely. It was probably the first time I was like, I dropped my jaw and seeing a person. I was like, jeez.
Who else was really cool to see in person, either playing actually on the court or walking past? Who else were you like, wow?
Dwayne Wade and his wife were at an event to kick off the week because they had events all week for the host, different people that were hosting events. The company that I partnered with, Utah Black Chamber and Microsoft, they were having events from Tuesday until the day of the All-Star game. So
crazy.
It was a lot of stuff for people to come and do beforehand, even the weekend started. So Dwayne Wade and his wife were at a couple of events. I was able to see them. The assistant coach, J.D. Dubois, for the Los Angeles Lakers led a panel that I was able to sit front row in and talk to him And we might have a few people that would love to come on the show.
Love
We're not
going
to spoil that today. Frank Jackson, he formerly played for the Detroit Pistons. I was able to talk with him personally one-on-one. And then one of the big ones, Isaiah Thomas, you know, he was just an all-out professional, class act. And, you know, I'm starting to realize I always wondered why MJ hated that guy. But it's a couple of things he'll say under the rug that really gets you. Not to me, but just I've heard it. So I was like, I'm always going to be on MJ's side. But it was just all out very good experience, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah, so take me through the media availability. Like, how hectic was it being able to – were there certain press conferences that were worse than others? Were there certain times that were better than others? How hectic or non-hectic would it all be?
You know, I think the – every event was so detailed that it wasn't as hectic as people would think. I mean, everybody knew that at this certain time we have to be here, has to start by here. I think one of the things that helped is that you were working with a lot of people that were notable, so they got places to be, things to go. So, you know, you're running on a quick time scale. You can't really afford to be late for anything. And then when the event actually started, you were getting nothing but the raw and unfiltered opinions of these people. It was just really good to see them beyond maybe a television screen, because you get to see the humanistic side of them a lot more.
So was it easy to be able to ask them questions, or was it more like everyone else was taking over and you were just kind of listening?
It was a mixture of a lot of people wanting to just ask questions, and then also nerves. Like, I think one of the biggest things that I realized when I was able to talk to some of these people was that I was nervous. I didn't want to make it seem like I didn't know what I was talking about or mess up and misquote something, and then they won't want to answer a question. So it was just a mixture of those two. But really, once that first question came out of my mouth for a lot of those people, I felt a little bit better about, you know, the situation I was in.
I completely understand that, because even when I interview high-profile athletes here at Illinois State, which is just, you know, even just famous within a small community, I get a little nervous that I'm going to get something wrong. They're going to, you know, not want to answer my questions. So interviewing an NBA Hall of Famer and Isaiah Thomas or Frank Jackson, a current player, as you said, and stuff like that, can't even imagine that you kind of have to let your nerves aside. But, okay, so let's get to the actual game. You were there, and I personally thought it was fine. I watched most of it, and I watched most of the Saturday night stuff. But a lot of people are hating on the game. I remember Michael Malone, the Nuggets coach, yesterday said it was, quote, the worst NBA All-Star game he ever saw. What can you say as somebody who was there in person? Do you feel like it was a poor game, or do you think it was decent competition?
Yeah, it's so ironic you said that. My uncle, he looked over to me. He was like, so when is this thing going to pick up? I was like, you know, typically it picks up around the end of the game, you know, when the game, the score is close.
Yeah.
But we didn't see that this year. I mean, me and my uncle, we actually left at the beginning of the fourth because the West All-Stars were leading by a good, or Giannis's team was leading by a good 20-plus points.
Yeah.
And it was just like, there's no reason for us to be here. The target score is probably 15 points away. So, I mean, it just wasn't competitive. The guys, you know, I think a couple of times I noticed Ja Morant wasn't even running up and down the court. I was like, okay, this is what we're doing here. And it's surprising because the past few years we've said the All-Star game has looked a lot better. This week, I don't know, maybe it was the hotel food that they didn't really do well the night before, but they just were moving a little lackadaisical, slow. It was definitely noticeable.
Well, when you lose both of the team captains in the game, like, did that sort of suck the energy out of the arena? Was there a lot of grumbling between people and media? What sort of happened when that sort of development happens in mid-game?
Yeah, I think it took a lot of people a long time to notice, honestly, because I didn't notice until well into the third quarter that LeBron had been sitting on the bench, you know, since the first half. So I think it just took a lot of people to notice it, but you're absolutely right. You got to think about it. They came into this game, both sides, didn't have Kevin Durant, didn't have Steph Curry from previous injuries, and then you lose Giannis after the first play of the game, and then, I was about to say Michael Jordan.
No.
LeBron.
I mean, but that might very well be the top four right there.
Yeah.
I mean, not including Nikola Jokic or anyone else along those lines. Like, that may very well be the top four players in the league that you're without.
Yeah, and it was just, it left a lot for guys that typically aren't in the All-Star game to, it was big shoes that they had to fill. I mean, Jason Tatum had a really good second half.
Yeah.
But, you know, that can only go so far.
I remember you know, you said you didn't get to see Steph or KD or Giannis, but you did see LeBron play for the first half. And I remember going to – Giannis is actually one of these examples. I've been to very few NBA games, but when I've gone to NBA games, more than any other sport for some reason, I don't know, maybe it's because the NBA players are so – they're big personalities. But it seems like when going to NBA games, like seeing a player on the court, instead of watching the game, I'll sometimes just follow the player. If they're a star. Like when I went to a Bucks and Timberwolves game a couple years ago, I just followed Giannis the whole time. And then Karl-Anthony Towns occasionally, because it's like you're seeing a star play. Is that how you felt watching the All-Star game, or was it just too much going on? You know, you couldn't even follow LeBron and stuff like that.
No, my eyes were glued on LeBron James. I'm not even going to lie.
Was that your first time seeing him play in person?
First time seeing him in person. I've had the privilege to have seen a couple of those guys in person just from Bulls games over the years. But LeBron has never been one of them. I've seen Damian Lillard, I've seen Giannis, like you said, but never a guy on LeBron's magnitude, especially after, you know, becoming the all-time leading scorer. It just made it all the more, the aesthetic of the whole situation that I was in was just all the more sweeter knowing that he was there playing, because a couple weeks ago, that guy was sitting on the bench hurt after he broke the record, so I was just glad that he was able to play. That was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, you know. I've told a lot of people that you start to really appreciate guys, and I've told you all, appreciate guys like LeBron James and Tom Brady who are really up in their age and, you know, they don't have as much, you know, years left in their respective leagues. So to be able to see him play is a story and a memory I'll be able to keep forever.
How many All-Star games do you think he has left in him?
As many years as he played. He's not ever going to. No one's not going to vote him for.
Oh, no, I didn't mean that. I just meant that was my way of asking years will he play still. Question.
So I know he wants to play with Bronny, and Bronny comes in next year after Victor Wembanyama.
Yeah.
So maybe two or three more years.
Yeah.
It depends on how he does when Bronny gets in the league. So if they really do team up and they can compete, and let's say
depends where it is.
Yeah, and let's say they lose that first year. I don't think he's going to go off on a playoff loss with his son. I think he wants to win the championship.
I mean, maybe he gets the Ichiro treatment. Like, when Ichiro retired, he played, like, one last series with Seattle.
In Japan, right?
In Japan. Yeah. So, like, maybe he just gives himself, a little tiny contract that gives him an opportunity to play with or against him. And then
I'll tell you what. He sure does have – he hasn't slowed down one bit. He's one of the leading scorers in the NBA.
That's why it's crazy, yeah. Watching him play, it's ridiculous.
So it's not really a matter of – if he can, it's a matter of if he wants to at this
point. Well, it's kind of crazy. And I've always felt, you know, I've always been in the whole, like, Jordan train. If you have to pick a side, which I've always felt it's kind of silly to pick a side. But if I had to, I'd say Jordan for the longest time. But and I still would. But LeBron, especially like David said in the last couple of weeks, after breaking the scoring record and stuff, it's kind of crazy to consider how old he is and how nuts it is he's still doing this. Like, people were saying, why did the Heat sign Kevin Love? He's so old. He shouldn't be in the league anymore. He's so old. He's 4 years younger than LeBron James, which is nuts if you think about it like that. I was thinking about that as people were hating on Kevin Love, and I'm like, no one's saying this about LeBron James because he literally transcends that age. And if I'm going to respect Tom Brady for that, I have to respect LeBron James for that.
You know, there's two things, or I guess three things now, that age well over time. Wine, a good cigar, and LeBron James. They just keep getting better as the years go on. You just let them sit there, and eventually they're going to produce some pretty good stuff.
Do you think LeBron would ever let himself have a Brady-type year, though, like Tom did in his last year, where, like, he just showed signs of he's human finally?
You know, it's funny that you say that, because I thought that he was starting to show signs of slowing down when he first got with the Lakers.
Yeah.
And they just weren't able to win. Mm. But he's really started to pick it up over these last 2-3 years, and it's just, oh, my goodness. I don't know how long he's going to play, but he's got at least 4 to 5 more years left.
Yeah, it's why you've got to be able to take advantage and appreciate a talent as great as that, because you never know if you're going to be having someone as good as that in any given year in the NBA once he retires.
And, you know, I heard something funny the other day. Every time he scores, he's setting a new record.
Yeah. A new scoring record. It's crazy. Yeah, and as so long as he's played in the NBA, that record becomes even more and more unbreakable. I really don't know. I mean, I think people say that Luka's kind of on the right track, but he'd have to play a long career. And I think we're going to wrap up the segment on that. We're going to do a quick test with the mics over at the basketball game, because we're going to have those guys right as Red Zone is over. But when we come back, you're going to get 15 more minutes of us, because we're going to talk about Redbird women's basketball. You're listening to the Red Zone.
Hi, this is Paul DeYoung, former ISU Redbird, current St. Louis Cardinal. You're listening to Red Zone on WZND.
Welcome back to the Red Zone. I'm Mikey Fernelli alongside David Moses and Braden Fogerson. Pretty soon, in about 10 minutes, if you're sick of us, you'll get rid of us because you're going to get Ben Howell, Benjamin Hootie, and Jameson Warfield. They're going to have your call of WZND women's basketball. Luke Biondi, who joined us for a segment earlier, he's there as well on press, so you can follow along his live tweets of the game at WZND Sports. And yeah, we actually have a photographer there tonight as well, so we have a whole crew out there at CEFQ Arena for the game tonight, and none of us are there, so we get a chance now to talk about the women's team themselves. And they suffered a tough loss over the weekend to Drake, but all things considered, they've had a great season. Coach Gillespie's best season in the Valley as Illinois State head coach, and it's crazy because she already has been to the national tournament once before, so exceeding expectations and then some, guys.
Yeah, for sure. And this team, the energy as you get closer and closer to these tournaments is really ramping up. And we've been talking about it the past several weeks. They don't need to prove anything else other than just get themselves ready to go. So everything that you can do to get those jitters out, you know, that I mean, the end of this schedule is really kind of difficult a little bit. That you got some several pretty good teams there as well. A couple really nice tests. Obviously, they got tested by Drake and Missouri State already. So you get that stuff out now before everything counts.
These wins are going to mean a lot more than we think, I think. You got teams that, or the opponents of these last four, UIC, Valparaiso, Evansville, and Indiana State, see them losing two of their last three saying, ooh, let's get them while they're limping.
Yeah.
You know, if you're ISU, you want to say, nope, we've been proving everybody wrong all year. We've been producing. We're going to come out here and get these last four, which is very doable, I think. This is a very talented team. But, you know, you also got to realize that when you're one of the best teams, you're going to get the best performance from the opponent at least 90% of the time.
USC 7-9 on the year, lost to ISU in their only meeting so far this season by a total of 13. So that was during ISU's incredible win streak there that surmounted about 10 or 11 games. And they still stand at the top of the conference, tied with two other teams now, though, at 13-3. So, you know, a couple big wins here in these last four would really help them secure that one or two seed going into the Quad Cities. It's Belmont and Northern Iowa, both 13-3 on the season, followed by Missouri State at 12-4. Then Drake 11-5, USC 7-9, as I said, that they're right in the middle of the pack. Then kind of like men's, there's like three teams that have six wins, and then Indiana State 5-11, and then at the very bottom, the Bradley Braves 0-16. Wouldn't want to be in Peoria right now.
And you know, it's very easy to say. You know, the public relations answer is always going to be, we're not focused on seeding, we're not focused on this and that. We just want to go out there and produce night in and night out. But you got to believe that Coach Gillespie and her coaching staff is murmuring that to her roster, you know, throughout the week during practices and film, you know, just to add some more competitive nature to the games ahead. Like, it's always going to be enforced just quietly around the locker room.
Yeah, and when you come off two losses, as I said, against those two teams that are up there with you, you're going to get some grumblings of, oh, fraud, like this team isn't really that good and stuff like that. To be able to light a fire, that's up to Coach Gillespie now to light a fire under them to make sure that they are going to give it their all, because, you know, if you only look at the past few days, the past couple of games, you know, you could start to make that sort of storyline work, especially considering up at the top there's just so many different teams that are all really good.
So that weekend in Iowa, I said last week before that weekend trip that I almost said it was a blessing in disguise that the win streak was broken before the road trip against Missouri State. But then they barely beat Northern Iowa, and then they lost pretty heavily to Drake on Saturday. So, yeah, they are limping right now. But I think, as David said, and as Fogerson has said as well, you got to take this as a chance to say, we are still tied for first in this conference. It's not, you know, sometimes if you lose two out of three games at the end of the season, you are going to fall three or four spots. But you have 10 straight wins, I think, for securing that number one spot. So, four games left. You got a chance to secure your one seed and go into that tournament as the team to beat. And I think the ball is obviously in their court, and they have every right to go do that. And it starts tonight against USC and Saturday against Valpo, both at home.
Yeah, and don't overthink it either, because this team is able to rely on the fact that they've got so many good shooters. Sometimes it doesn't really matter everything else, even though they are really good at everything else. If you can get yourself some shots together and get hot early, which these teams have some microwaves on them for sure, so they are able to rely on, if nothing else is working, being able to shoot as well as they do. But usually they do have a lot of stuff working.
So looking at this game coming up here, what do the Redbirds need to do to squeak past a team like UIC? Are we leaning on Deanna Wilson and some of the more talented veterans on the team, or are we spreading out the production? What's going to be the game plan going into this game?
Well, to me, working off what didn't work against Drake, and then also being able to learn from what did work the last time you faced UIC. And when you can look at, when you can watch film, when you can come up with new plays, obviously you're not trying to call the exact same plays you were early in the season. You want to be able to get some new stuff in there that you're working on and be a little bit less than predictable. But just being able to learn a lot about your opponent and what hasn't been working the past time out, if you, whatever mindset you need to be able to get into to work that out, as long as they can do everything consistently, as long as they can have themselves in the right mindset, they should be all right.
They win when they connect from three. Sorry to cut you off, David, but that's my quick note. Against Drake, 9 for 25 as a team from beyond the arc. Mary Crompton, as always, played really well, 4 for 6 beyond the arc, but Kate Bullman, 1 for 7 from downtown, Maya Wong 2 for 5, and very uncharacteristic Paige Robinson 0 for 4 from beyond the arc. So definitely had some practice this week on the long distance shooting, saying that is how they win games, and they're going to need that to come back tonight, David.
And, you know, looking at this box score from the last outing against UIC, defense was really big. UIC didn't score more than 1 point in the second quarter in their last meeting against the Redbirds. So, and then another thing is offensively they did produce. They shot 50% from the field, with four scorers going in double digits, being Kate Bullman with 12, Paige Robinson with 12, Deanna Wilson with 15, and Mary Crompton with 12. I mean, the production was widespread between these players. It's going to be interesting to see if the Redbirds kind of go towards the same trend this game.
Yeah, and even coming off the bench with Abby Alsma getting 12 points, I mean, that was some really, really good production as well. So to be able to expand your game beyond just the starting five is a really big deal as well, especially when it's someone that hasn't been able to get as many opportunities throughout the year, so that your opponent doesn't really know a whole lot about their tendencies.
And another thing to look at, you know, you don't typically pay too much attention, is that, you know, this is one of the last home games for these seniors. I know Saturday is going to be senior day, but, you know, every almost last game of the season, especially for the seniors that won't be returning next year, is always going to be a special one, and they're going to want to squeak out a win just for, you know, one last time.
So this team obviously has just four games left, as I said. Both of those games this week that are home will be carried on WZND, UIC tonight, and then Saturday at 4, Valpo. We will have that one as well. Not next week, as they travel out to Indiana to face Evansville and Indiana State, but then they will be back on the Pulse of Redbird Nation with Braden Fogerson and Tim Zalabak on the call. As long as they continue to win that weekend in Moline for the conference tournament, you will get a call from those two. We're going to wrap up pretty soon, but first and foremost, guys, I want to get your guys' score prediction for tonight's game against USC. Usually when we do this, I got really close last time against Bradley, remember? So I want to hear your guys' score predictions.
So this is going to be – so I'm going to say, because, you know, like I was saying earlier, I think the Redbirds are going to have something to prove here, you know, after these two losses. I think they're going to be coming out with a chip on their shoulder. So I think they're going to win this one pretty well. I'll say 85-67.
Wow, beatdown.
Yep.
Well, not even a beatdown, just a lot of points. Braden?
And for me, coming off of an 68-65 final in overtime last Friday, that's got to be factored into account. You've got to consider the fact that Illinois State is also coming off of a very tough loss. I feel like both of these teams are going to be not exactly peak energy, and so I feel like you're going to have kind of a slow start unless you get this, what Illinois State women's basketball kind of often does, gets off to a huge start. Unless they get off to a huge start, I feel like it's going to be a very low-scoring game, and I'm going to lean toward that, and so I'm going to go with 50 for UIC and 59 for Illinois State.
Okay, so a different story than what David said. I feel like I kind of sit in between you guys here. I think they're going to be really solid from beyond the arc. I think they're going to snap out of whatever happened against Drake and connect a lot. So I think it'll be somewhere in the 70s. Give me 74-62 is what I'm going to go with on that one. A nice even score, about a 12-point margin. And I think that's where we're going to wrap up this edition of the Red Zone. Thank you for listening. For David Moses and Braden Fogerson, I'm Mikey Pernelli. Also for Luke Biondi, we thank you for listening and have a great night. Stay tuned to WZND. About 10 minutes, you'll get some Redbird basketball.
Hear this and other past episodes of The Red Zone again? Download the Red Zone podcast online at WZND.com or on iTunes. And of course, tune into The Red Zone every Thursday at 6, right here on 103.3 WZND,
the pulse of Redbird Nation.